This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Thank you for coming and your patience in getting everybody seated. Again, I'm Betty Smoot. And I don't know if you have my email address, but I'm going to give it to you anyway in just a minute. So we'll just press on. So here's the Facebook page for the Mini Med School with some information on it about this program. So I posted a pretest on the cardiovascular system, primarily the heart. So if you go to the Facebook page, there's the Facebook address, and you could take the pretest. And it's not graded, but the answers will appear. But I'm also going to post a post-test, but it won't really be a post-test. It's going to be a blend of tonight's information and the information from next week. So it's anatomy of the heart and cardiovascular system or circulatory system. And as an incentive to do it, for the first, say, 10 people that post that get the right answers, complete 100% correct, we'll give prizes out next time. So there's your incentive to do the quiz. Okay. So for those of you that may not have a Facebook account, if you were thinking about ever doing that, now's a good time. But if not and you still want to do the quiz, send me an email and I'll send it to you. So it's betty.smoot@ucsf.edu. So that's pretty easy. Okay, so we'll press on. The circulatory system or the cardiovascular system really consists of the heart and the many blood vessels, the arteries, the veins, and the capillaries that make up the system. It also consists of the pulmonary circulation, which is the blood flow from the heart to the lungs, where the blood will pick up oxygen and then return to the heart, and then the systemic circulation, which is the circulation from the heart carrying oxygenated blood out to the body to provide oxygen to the cells, and then the blood returning to the heart, and then the coronary circulation, which is the way in which the heart itself receives its blood. So we're going to talk about the pulmonary and the systemic and the coronary circulation next time and the blood vessels that support that, and tonight we'll focus on the heart. So here are our objectives. So first, we're going to describe the location of the heart in the thorax and the mediastinum, and I'll just sort of define what those structures are. We want to enable you to relate the surface anatomy that we see and can palpate or feel to the underlying structures related to the cardiovascular system, specifically the heart. We're going to describe the anatomy of the heart, including the coverings of the heart, the chambers of the heart, the walls of the heart, and the valves, and the functions of the valves, and very briefly, what happens if the valves become incompetent. And then one of the overarching goals of these two lectures tonight and next week is to provide you with a foundation of an anatomical knowledge about the heart and cardiovascular system that will allow you to apply that to some of the conditions, the physiology and the pathology that will be presented in future lectures. All right. Here's the heart. This is sort of an Frank Netterized version of what the heart looks like, but it's pretty close. And really, it's just a muscle. So I say that sort of flippantly. It's not really just a muscle, right? It's a pretty important muscle because it really pumps all the blood to the heart, to the body, to the brain. So it has a very big job. And that oxygenated blood is essential to sustain the life of the cells that keep you alive. So this is an important structure. So it's not just a muscle, but it is purely muscle tissue. Sometimes, though, this is the way we describe the heart, right? It looks like it has this scalloped top with a pointy bottom, and that's the way it's drawn. And sometimes it'll have an arrow through it, like, you know, shot with Cupid's arrow, and you're going to fall in love. Sometimes you'll see initials carved in a heart, which will sort of permanently link you to your sixth grade crush. And there are also, you probably can think of 1,000 sayings that have the heart in them, right? Follow your heart, matters of the heart. So when I was in sixth grade, it was all about Philip. That's the P. So that's my maiden, H is the maiden name. So it was all about Philip. So I saw him across the room, and he was the heartthrob, right? So my heart skipped a beat. He was a sweetheart. He was a real sweetheart, I thought, until he wasn't anymore, and it broke my heart. Aw. Yeah, thank you. So I wanted to get to the heart of the matter. So we had a heart-to-heart talk. And I poured out my heart. But to no avail, then I cried my heart out. So I've discovered, in the process of being burned by Philip, that falling in love is not for the faint of heart. So with a heavy heart, I moved on to MH. That was Mark. And then to Todd, who's my husband. And it mended my broken heart. So we describe the heart not really in anatomical and physiological terms in conversation. You know, when you talk about the heart with your friends, you're talking about it kind of from a historical perspective, how we perceived it as sort of the center of emotion and spirituality. But that's not all that the heart is about. Here's some more sayings. Some of these sayings really bring to mind, to me, some anatomical structures. So, tug at one's heartstrings. I'll show you a picture of what I think of when I think about heartstrings. In your heart of hearts, I'm not really sure what that means. We only have one heart, and the heart doesn't have a heart, so you can make of that what you like. Eat your heart out, that's just weird. And then the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, that's just wrong. So I'll try to prove that to you as we move along. Okay, so here is your trunk, right? Your trunk is this headless, armless, legless part of your body. And the thorax is the upper part of the trunk, and that's where the heart is. So the heart is contained in this thoracic cage. And the thoracic cage consists of this musculoskeletal structure that surrounds the inside. There's muscle, there's skeleton, there's skin, there's tissue. That's the body wall. And then there's an internal cavity that contains all these structures that you see here. The heart, the lungs, some of the structures you don't see, like the esophagus, the trachea, the thymus, the nerves and vessels that are contained in the thorax. So I want to discuss the thoracic cage. That's a giant thoracic cage. I want to discuss this because it's important for two reasons. One is that the thoracic cage protects the viscera, the organs that are contained inside of it, which includes the heart. So this is a protective structure. The other reason that I think it's important to learn the thoracic anatomy when you're studying the heart is that we use the surface anatomy structures that overlie these bony landmarks to help us determine where the heart is, where to listen for heart sounds, you know, where the structures are that we're trying to diagnose if you're seeing a physician or if you are a physician. So we'll talk about some of these structures now. I can't move. So let's start by looking at the thoracic spine. The skeletal components of the thoracic cage include the 12 thoracic vertebrae, which are behind the sternum here, but here are the lower few down here. That's posterior. So posterior just means toward the back. And then anteriorly here, we see the sternum, or the breastbone. And the sternum is divided into three sections. There's a manubrium at the top, there's the body of the sternum here, and then the xiphoid process. So that's the posterior and the anterior elements of the thoracic cage. And then you can see that the rest of the thoracic cage is bounded by the ribs. So there are 12 pairs of ribs. You'll also notice that anteriorly, the ribs are extended by the costal cartilages. So you have a bony element to the rib and then a costal cartilage that then for the first seven ribs attaches the ribs to the sternum anteriorly. The last, or the ribs 8, 9, and 10 connect by the way of their costal cartilage to the costal cartilages of rib 7. And then the last two ribs, 11 and 12, are just floating ribs. But this system allows for expansion of the rib cage during respiration. In between each of the ribs, you'll notice a space, and the space is filled with muscles and nerves and vessels. But in between those, we call those the intercostal spaces, okay? And they're numbered. So each of the ribs is numbered, 1 through 12. Thus, each of the intercostal spaces is numbered as well for the rib above it. So this right here where I'm pointing would be the first intercostal space and the second intercostal space, etc. Okay? So then let's look at the surface anatomy that we use to identify locations for underlying structures. So if you just put your fingers between the two bumps on the top of your, sort of the superior aspect of your thoracic cage, this is the medial meaning closer to midline. This is the medial aspect of your clavicle, okay? And then there's a dip in the middle, and that's your jugular notch, okay? Then if you take your fingers just inferiorly from your jugular notch and palpate the flat bone, that's the manubrium of the sternum. Now, if you just keep going inferiorly or down toward the floor, you'll feel a bump. Everybody feel that? That's the sternal angle, or the manubriosternal junction. That's here. So there's the manubrium, and there's the sternal angle, or the manubriosternal junction. And the reason I point that out is because attached to that manubriosternal junction is the costal cartilage of the second rib. So if you palpate laterally or away from midline, you can feel the second costal cartilage and then the second rib. So why do we care about that? Because below or inferior to that second rib is the second intercostal space. And that's an important landmark for auscultation of heart sounds, which we'll come back to in a bit. All right. Other structures then in the thoracic cage, in addition to the heart, are the lungs, which you see here, and the heart between the two lungs. So we use these landmarks that we've just discussed, the second costal cartilage, the second intercostal space. We can count down to find the fifth intercostal space, which really marks the inferiormost aspect of the heart. So that's as far down as the heart goes. If we draw a line from the midpoint of your clavicle, which is your collarbone, if you draw a line straight down inferiorly, that is the midclavicular line, and that is the lateralmost aspect of the left side of the heart. So now you can kind of figure out how you would draw the heart on yourself, on your chest, because you know some of the contours and landmarks that describe its location. So here is the outline of the heart. Here is the fifth intercostal space, kind of just about even with the inferior aspect of the heart, and then coming up to the midclavicular line. So now let's take off the anterior aspect of the thoracic cage and look inside and see what we see. So we see two lungs, each one contained in a pleural sac surrounded by the pleural cavity. And then between each lung, between the lungs, is the pericardium, which contains the heart. Okay, so the mediastinum is this section between the two lungs. It's just basically the middle section of the thoracic cage. And it contains the heart, which is surrounded by the pericardium, and then the other structures in the area, which would be the great vessels that lead to and leave the heart, the nerves that innervate the heart, the great vessels that bring deoxygenated blood to the heart and oxygenated blood away to the systemic circulation. Now, if we let me just show you this pericardium here. Remember, this is a sac that contains the heart, and you'll notice that it attaches to the diaphragm inferiorly. So this diaphragm is the primary muscle of respiration, and as you breathe in and out, your diaphragm moves. So because of this connection of the pericardium to the diaphragm, the heart actually moves when you breathe as well. So this pericardial sac is continuous anteriorly to posteriorly, superiorly to inferiorly. And if we take the heart out, then we can see that the pericardium is actually continuous. Okay, so we removed the heart here. The pericardium has three layers of tissue associated with it. In this first picture, you see the outermost layer, which is the fibrous pericardium. That's a dense connective tissue. And when we take the heart out of its sac, then we can see the inner lining of the fibrous pericardium. This is lined by a layer of thinner tissue called serous pericardium that actually produces a serous fluid. Okay? So, what are the three layers? So, we've talked about the fibrous pericardium, and we've talked about one of the layers of the serous pericardium. This schematic here is just a cross-section of the heart. This blue outer layer is actually part of the lining that covers the lung, and that abuts up against the pericardium. So what we'll see here, this little gray area, is the fibrous pericardium. That's the tough outer connective tissue. Then we'll see two layers of serous pericardium. There's the layer that is lining that fibrous pericardium on the inside. That's called the parietal serous pericardium. So anytime you talk about a parietal structure, you're talking about something that's kind of on the wall. Okay? The other layer of the serous pericardium is the visceral serous pericardium. That is also a serous membrane, helps to produce the serous fluid, but it's continuous with the heart. It lines the heart itself, and you can't really peel it off of the heart. So if you're just looking at the heart tissue, it's covered by visceral pericardium. Viscera just means organ. So one of the things that I want you to look at in this picture is the fibrous pericardium, the gray, surrounding the heart and becomes continuous kind of up near the great organs with the outer coverings, It becomes continuous with the coverings around those great vessels. But what you'll notice about the serous layers is that they fold around and back on one another. So if you imagine a balloon that's kind of just blown up a little bit and closed off on one at the end, right? So it's just like a kind of a halfway deflated balloon. And you stick your hand in it. If your hand is the heart and you stick your hand in the balloon, the covering of the balloon that's around your heart is the visceral pericardium. The layer of pericardium that's around on the outside of that visceral serous pericardium is the parietal serous pericardium. So there's two layers, but they're continuous with one another. Does that make sense? And they're continuous kind of at the great vessels at the top. That arrangement creates a space between the two layers of serous pericardium, right? So we have a parietal layer and a visceral layer and a space in between. And we've already said that the serous membranes produce a serous fluid. So there's a serous fluid in between those two layers, and that's the pericardial fluid in the pericardial cavity. Does that make sense? Okay. So what is the purpose of that? It helps to decrease friction of the heart in the pericardium so that the heart can change shape and beat. All right, so we've looked at this picture and talked about the layers of the pericardium. Now, in this picture below, we've seen the fibrous pericardium. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take a cross-section through the mediastinum. So remember, the mediastinum is just this sort of middle section. That's really what we're interested in looking at in this next image. So here's a cross-section. When you look at a cross-section, an anatomical cross-section, you need to imagine the person whose cross-section this is lying on their back. Here's the spine, Here's the sternum in the front. So we know this is posterior and anterior. So they're lying on their back. And their feet are out toward you, just for orientation. All right. So what I want to show you in the picture, this layer right here, this outer layer, is the fibrous pericardium lined by the parietal serous pericardium. And then the inner layer that's really flush up against the heart is the visceral serous pericardium. Okay, so it's really attached firmly to the myocardial or the cardiac muscle. Another name for the visceral serous pericardium is epicardium. And then you can see the space in between the pericardial cavity. So you can see how if the heart were to move, beat, get bigger, smaller, it could be accommodated and allowed to move by virtue of the fact that there's fluid in between the two layers of serous pericardium. So what happens if there's excess fluid in that pericardial space? You get something called cardiac tamponade. The fibrous pericardium is a very dense connective tissue, and it's not stretchable, right? It's a very firm, containing structure. So if you get extra fluid, either swelling, like an effusion, or blood, then since the fibrous pericardium can't expand, then there's increased pressure on the heart tissue itself. And that can be life-threatening. It's very dangerous. So here's this example of the fibrous pericardium here and blood filling the pericardial cavity and compressing the heart. So we know that blood returns to the heart and blood leaves the heart. But if the heart is being squeezed, not as much blood can get back into the heart. So if, for example, the blood can't enter the heart through the superior vena cava, then you're going to see venous distension in the veins that lead to the vena cava. So you'll have venous distension in the neck, in the face, in the arms. Additionally, if there's less blood entering, there's going to be less blood leaving. So what you'll see then is you'll see decreased arterial and pulse pressures. So blood pressure is going to go down. And that can be life-threatening if it's too low. So the treatment for that is to do a pericardiocentesis, where a needle is inserted into that sac between the two layers of serous pericardium. So that's typically done through guided ultrasound, because that would be, you know, you want to be very precise when you're doing that kind of a procedure, right? So the blood is drained and can be taken in for diagnostic reasons, purposes, but also to relieve the pressure around the heart. All right, so we've looked at the fibrous pericardium. And now we're going to take the fibrous pericardium off and look at the inside and look at the structures of the heart itself. So we're going from outside and getting further and further in and a little bit more detailed. All right. So you notice already that the heart is sort of set obliquely in the mediastinum, right? It's kind of on its side a little bit. Let's identify some structures. We've already identified the right lung and the left lung. What you see if you just look anteriorly at the chest, an open mediastinum, is you'll see the right atrium and the right ventricle and the left ventricle. This little angle down here is the apex of the heart, and that corresponds to the left ventricle. The heart has two atria and two ventricles, and in this anatomical position, this anatomical orientation, the atria are off to the side. They're to the right and slightly posterior to the ventricles. You'll notice that if this is midline here, most of the heart is off to the left, but not all of it. So about a third of the heart is actually to the right of midline. If you think about the size of the heart, you know, your own fist is about the size of your own heart. That's variable. You know, as we age or we have changes in heart or heart disease, then the heart may be bigger than that. And it weighs less than a pound usually, half a pound to maybe three quarters of a pound. It's very light. All right, so let's look at the great vessels of the heart. Two lungs again. Here's our heart in the middle of the two lungs. We have the right atrium, right ventricle, and left atrium. So let's start by following the blood into the heart. So deoxygenated blood from the systemic circulation enters the heart through two vessels, the superior vena cava and the inferior vena cava. So here is your superior vena cava, bringing blood back to the heart from head, neck, upper extremities, and it enters the right atrium, carrying deoxygenated blood. The inferior vena cava is bringing blood, deoxygenated blood again to the heart from the lower body, from the gastrointestinal system, from the abdomen, entering the right atrium as well. Then the blood from the right atrium is going to be moved into the right ventricle through an atrioventricular orifice. So here's our right ventricle. The blood from the right ventricle, still deoxygenated, is going to leave the heart through the pulmonary trunk, which splits to right and left pulmonary arteries. Okay, you with me? That's still deoxygenated blood, though, right? Right, so it hasn't gone to the lungs yet. So, you know, if you learn that the arteries always leave the heart and always carry oxygenated blood, that's not precisely true, right? Based on this, because this is actually deoxygenated blood leaving the heart. So arteries do always leave the heart, but in this case, this artery carries low oxygen blood. All right, so those are on their way to the lungs to pick up oxygen. And then on their return then, once they've done their gas exchange, they're going to come back toward the heart via these vessels here, which are the pulmonary veins. Okay? So now that is oxygenated blood. So pulmonary veins, two from each side, coming together to essentially form the left atria. So in this example, the aorta has been cut away so that we can see the left atrium, because you can't really see the left atrium from this anterior view. So blood from the left atrium then is going to enter the left ventricle, and then it's going to be pumped out through the aorta to the systemic circulation. Okay. So now we've talked about just the general sort of orientation of the heart in the thorax, kind of what the parts are. So we want to go into a bit more detail about the specifics of the external features, and then we'll talk about specifics of the internal features of the heart. So we'll take a closer look at the external features first. So you see the superior vena cava, which enters the atrium, the right atrium, really at the top superior dome of the atrium. Then you can't really see the inferior vena cava in this view. It's a little bit too posterior to see. But we see the right atrium, and then you see this other little part of the atrium here called the auricle, which means ear. Okay. So this is a little flap that's attached to the right ear, part of the right atrium, that actually increases the capacity of the right atrium. One thought is that the atrium is sort of a developmental, not an anomaly, but a developmental feature. But one of the problems is that if you have, say, atrial fibrillation, where you have this irregular heartbeat, and the atrium is fibrillating, you're contracting sort of irregularly and too fast, and you're not generating a good ventricular beat, that blood can pool in the atrium, and it may pool in the right auricle. And blood that pools is at risk for clotting. And clots can be dislodged and move through the heart and then end up somewhere else, like the brain or the lungs. So that's one of the complications of atrial fibrillation, and this is one of the areas that the blood is thought to perhaps pool. All right, so what else do we see in this diagram? So from the right atrium, then the blood is moving to the right ventricle and then out the pulmonary trunk, again, as we said, on its way to the lungs, and then coming back through pulmonary veins, which with the pulmonary veins from the other side form the left atrium. And then the left atrium also has an auricle, or a little ear flap, that increases the capacity of the atrium. And then the left ventricle and the apex. And then again out the aorta. So those are the significant external features of the anterior view of the heart, or the sternocostal view of the heart. The other features that you'll see here are the coronary arteries that come off of the aorta. There's a right coronary artery and a left coronary artery. The left coronary artery has a big branch called the left anterior descending, which supplies the majority of the blood to the left ventricle. So atherosclerotic changes in this LAD, or the left anterior descending artery, can be very problematic for the health of the left ventricle and lead to ischemia and myocardial infarction. So now we're going to look at the posterior view of the heart. So again, you'll see the superior vena cava, but now we can see the inferior vena cava. And you'll see that they both enter the right atrium, as does the coronary sinus. So the coronary sinus collects the venous blood from the heart itself and dumps it into the right atrium. So the right atrium has three holes through which deoxygenated blood enters the channel, the chamber. Okay, so the superior and inferior vena cava and the coronary sinus. Again, we see the posterior aspect of the right ventricle. We don't see the pulmonary artery from this view because it really is more of an anterior structure, or the pulmonary trunk. But we do see the four pulmonary veins, and then in this view you can really see how the pulmonary veins just kind of come together to form the left atrium. All right, and then we can see the left ventricle and the apex again. You can see a groove here. This is the posterior interventricular groove, and that's really the separation between the two ventricles. The other thing that you can see on this that's interesting is the sinoatrial, the location of the sinoatrial node, which is the pacemaker of the heart. And we'll come back to that in a bit. All right, so we've looked at the external features of the heart. Now we want to try to move a little bit deeper and look at some of the internal features of the heart. We know that the heart has four chambers. And when we think of the heart itself as a pump, really it's a muscular pump that pumps the blood through the systemic circulation to the lungs and then to itself. But really we think of it as two separate pumps put together. So we have a right heart and a left heart. So the right heart is the right atrium and the right ventricle. So that's the heart for the that's the side of the heart for the deoxygenated blood. And then the left heart, which consists of the left atrium and the left ventricle, is the pump for the oxygenated blood. Yep, that's pretty straightforward, I think. So we can see that the right atrium and the right ventricle are connected by way of the atrioventricular orifice and guarded by the valve. On the left heart, you can see that the left atrium and left ventricle are connected by way of a left atrioventricular orifice and also guarded by a valve. So we'll come back to the valves in a little bit as well. The ventricles are separated by an interventricular septum. The atrium, the left and right atria, are also separated by an interatrial septum. The ventricular walls are much, much thicker than the atrial walls, because they have more work to do. They have to work against more pressure. They get thicker. They really pump the blood out into the circulation, so they are much, much thicker. During contraction of the heart, the atria contract together and the ventricles contract together. So even though we think of these two pumps sort of put together, two sides of the heart put together, serving different purposes, the atria contract together, followed by ventricular contraction, to help facilitate the movement of the blood. Back to the walls of the heart, we talked about the epicardium. Do you remember what the epicardium is? It's the serous pericardium that lines the heart. So that actually is considered one of the layers of the heart itself. So the visceral serous pericardium is the epicardium. The myocardium is the heart muscle itself. It's the cardiac tissue, cardiac muscle. And then that is lined by endocardium in all chambers. All right, so now we're going to go into much more detail about each of the chambers of the heart. This is the right atrium. We're going to go in order. So now what we can see is the superior vena cava emptying into the right atrium, the inferior vena cava entering into the right atrium, and you can see the opening of that coronary sinus. So here are our three openings into the right atrium. So there's some distinctive features about this part of the heart. One is that there's a fossa ovalis. Does anybody, have you guys heard of that, the fossa ovalis? Yeah? So it is the remnant of an opening between the two chambers, the right and left atria, that was a fetal shunt for blood bypassing the lungs. Okay. So that's the fossa ovalis. There's a septum between the two atria, the interatrial septum. There's also muscle, right? The heart is muscle. So this is the myocardium. But in the atrium, the name of that muscle is pectinate muscle. So pectinate means comb. It just looks sort of comb-like off of this ridge right here, which is the crista terminalis. Off of this ridge, this sort of ropey-looking muscle, that's the pectinate muscle. It just looks like the teeth of a comb. Then we see the opening from this right atrium to the right ventricle. So that's the atrioventricular orifice, which is guarded by this tricuspid valve. It's also called the right atrioventricular valve, or the tricuspid valve. So it's called tricuspid. Why? Because it has three cusps. All right. So now we'll move from the right atrium into the right ventricle. So we've cruised through that orifice, gone through the valves, and now we're in the right ventricle. So you can see that there's some marked differences between the atrium and the ventricle. One is that the walls of the ventricle is much thicker, as we've already said, but the muscle is much more, it's much thicker, and the network is a little bit more interwoven, a lot more just sort of rods and beams, a lot more supportive structure in the myocardium in the ventricle. So we call this trabeculae carnei. That means, so we know what carnei means, right?
Meat,
right. So this is the meat of the heart. Trabeculae means beams, like supporting structures. We also see these structures right here. Those are called papillary muscles. The papillary muscles still are cardiac tissue, but they specifically attach to these chordae tendinae, which attach to the cusps or to the leaflets of the valves. Okay? So we have papillary muscles attached to the chordae tendinae. So this is what I think of. These are the strings of the heart, right? And they attach to the tricuspid leaflets or the tricuspid valve. So when the heart beats, goes through its cardiac cycle, the atria contract first. That finishes pushing the blood into the ventricles. So that valve is going to be open. It's going to be wide open, right, for the blood to get from the atria to the ventricles. So it's just that increased pressure that opens the valve. Now, when the ventricles contract, the blood needs to go out, particularly from the right ventricle, it's going to need to go out to the pulmonary trunk, right, and then go to the lungs. You don't want it going back into the right atria. So those papillary muscles, as the ventricles contract, the papillary muscles are contracting too. So they keep the valves from everting back into the right atrium. Right? Does that make sense? Because if they didn't do that, if there was nothing holding the valves down, then the blood would just go back into the right atrium. So these, they don't open the valves. You don't want the muscles contract and open the valves because that creates the same problem. So they just keep the valves firmly closed and keep them from going back, from opening backwards. So important function. Okay, then we also see here, this is the direction that we want the blood to go, right? Not back up into the atrium, but out the pulmonary trunk. So this is the pulmonary valve. It's a tricuspid valve, but we don't call it tricuspid. We saved tricuspid for this one. This is just called the pulmonary or pulmonic valves or semilunar valves, because these valve cusps are sort of in the shape of a half moon. All right, so we've gone to the lungs. Our blood has gone out to the lungs through the pulmonary arteries, done its thing there, and then comes back toward the heart, now carrying oxygen. So we need to get the blood back into the left atrium now. So now we need to get to the left pump, the left side of the heart. That blood is going to enter the atrium through two right pulmonary veins and then two left pulmonary veins that have been cut away. So now we can see the inner surface of the left atrium. Pretty smooth. There's not a lot going on there. It's just kind of an extension of the veins coming together. There is an auricle up here. And the only place where you find those pectinate muscles that are sort of characteristic of the atria are in the left auricle on this side. You don't find the pectinate muscles in this part of the left atrium. All right, so left atrium through the mitral valve into the left ventricle. The left ventricle is much thicker in terms of its muscular wall. So the myocardial wall in the ventricle is very thick compared to the right side, because it has to pump out through the aorta, which is really a high-pressure system. So it really needs to have lots of strength to pump against that pressure in the arterial system. So it gets very thick. We see the trabeculae carnei again, characteristic of ventricles. You see the papillary muscles. And in this case, there are really only two sets of papillary muscles, because the mitral valve is a bicuspid valve. So it only has two papillary muscles, two sets of chordae tendinae attaching to an anterior and a posterior cusp of this valve, okay? So once this contracts then, the papillary muscles keep the bicuspid leaves from flipping back up into the left atrium so that the blood can then exit through the aorta, passing through the aortic valve, which we don't see on this picture, but we do here. So in this image, this is the tricuspid valve. So what is that ventricle that I'm pointing into? It's going to be the right side, right? So the right side between the atrium and the ventricle on the right is the tricuspid valve. So we've taken the atrium off. And we've taken the left atrium off, and we can look at through the atrioventricular orifice through this open valve into the left ventricle. Are you oriented to this? So we're looking kind of down at the top of the heart. These other two valves that are closed, we have the pulmonary valve and the aortic valve, and you can see that they're tricuspid. See, three cusps each, and they're sort of semilunar. They're half moon shaped. When they're closed like this, the cusps come up and meet together to close the orifice. And they are closed when the heart is in diastole. So when the ventricles are relaxed, there's no blood pumping out through them, so they're closed. Okay. When the ventricles are relaxed, they're filling up with blood before contraction. So these are going to be open because the blood is moving from the atria into the ventricles. So these are going to have to be open. Okay? So when the heart is in systole or contracting, when the ventricles are contracting, then we want the blood to be leaving the ventricles. So the blood from the right ventricle is going to leave through this orifice, through the pulmonary artery out to the lungs. And then from the left ventricle, it'll leave through the aortic orifice and through that valve out to the systemic circulation. There are fibrous rings surrounding each of the valves to give it structure, right? You have to have a firm sort of fibrous structure for the valves to attach to so that they can maintain their shape. So that's one of the functions of this fibrous skeleton of the heart. So most of the heart is really muscular tissue, but there is some connective tissue that helps to give it shape. So the fibrous skeleton that surrounds the valves allow an anchor for the valves, keeps them from over-dilating, stretching out. It also provides attachment. You can see this is myocardium here attaching to the fibrous skeleton. So the myocardium attaches to that fibrous skeleton and gives it an anchoring point. And then this fibrous skeleton also prevents electrical conduction too rapidly, because you can't get electrical impulses through the fibrous skeleton except in one specific area that I'll show you. Okay, so it blocks the spread of electrical impulses from the atria to the ventricular and slows it down. So here is the conducting system. So we talked about this sinoatrial node already a little bit, right? So we saw the sinoatrial node up by the atrium, the right atrium. And the sinoatrial node is the pacemaker of the heart. The conduction system of the heart are really specialized myocardial cells that are highly conductive. The sinoatrial node has the ability to sort of spontaneously generate its own pace, its own heartbeat. It's affected by the nerves that innervate the heart, but it has its own internally sort of generated pacing ability. So that's the SA node. When that fires off, the conduction is spread through the atrium bilaterally on both sides, right and left atrium, and then to the AV node, which is here. So this is embedded sort of in the interatrial septum. And then this crosses the fibrous skeleton of the heart. So this is how we get conduction from the atria to the ventricles, through this atrioventricular node, and then the continuation of those specialized cells through the interventricular septum. So these are called the AV bundle of His through the upper part of the interventricular septum, and then into the bundles. There's a right bundle branch and then a left bundle branch that continue to conduct these signals into these Purkinje fibers that go into the ventricles, then out to the papillary muscles around the walls of the heart and cause the ventricles to contract. So this is the conducting system of the heart. So we get contraction of the atria first, a little delay, about a 40 millisecond delay, and then contraction of the ventricles to pump the blood out of the ventricles into pulmonary and systemic circulation. So we'll talk a little bit more about the valves. So once again, right atrium, right ventricle, and the tricuspid valve and orifice connecting the two chambers of the right side of the heart. So again, we see the papillary muscles and the chordae tendineae and the three cusps of this on this side. And then on the left side, we see the bicuspid valve and the two papillary muscles. And then in this picture of the left ventricle, we can now see the aortic valve. Again, it's the semilunar valve, three cusps from left ventricle to the aorta. So what happens if we have problems with our valves? So we can have a number of different problems. One of the problems we can have with the valves is that they become stenotic. They can become calcified so that the orifice through which the blood goes is narrowed. The valves don't open. They don't close completely because they're stiff. So that's aortic stenosis. Another problem that's not uncommon is mitral valve prolapse. So if, for some reason, the papillary muscles are weak, or there's tearing or something of the valves where there's weakness in the valves themselves, then with contraction of the ventricle, the blood may flow out the aorta through the aortic valve as well, but some of it can go back into the left atrium. So that is a mitral valve prolapse. It's an incompetent mitral valve. And what you'll hear is a murmur when you're listening to heart sounds. And so I'll play you a bit of that in a second. So the blood regurgitates back into the left atrium during contraction of the ventricles. So as we As you remember, we talked about the places on the heart or places on the surface anatomy that you can identify underlying structures. You can use your surface anatomy to sort of outline the structures of the heart. You can also use those landmarks to determine where to listen to the valves. So if you look at this picture down here and you identify this tricuspid valve, if you were listening to this valve, the blood is flowing this way. So you want to listen to the valve distal to it or downstream from it. So you can hear the valve, the sounds being conducted, carried by the blood that's flowing through there. So you would listen to the tricuspid valve inferior to it. So here are the valves. Here is the tricuspid valve here. So you listen to the tricuspid valve below it. Now, if we were trying to listen to the mitral valve here, the blood is flowing in this direction. So you would listen to the mitral valve inferior to that valve, further downstream. So you would listen to that roughly in the fifth intercostal space. So you could identify your sternal angle, find your second rib, palpate your second intercostal space, and count down to the fifth intercostal space, and that's where you would listen for the heart sounds for the mitral valve. For the aortic valve, if the blood is flowing from the left ventricle through the aorta, the blood is traveling this way, superiorly, so we're going to listen to the aortic valve on the right side in the second intercostal space. So above and slightly to the right of the aortic valve. And then similarly for the pulmonic valve, we know that the blood from the right ventricle leaves through the pulmonary orifice, the pulmonic valve, here in this region here. So the blood's flowing this way. So if the pulmonic valve is here, then we're going to listen to the pulmonic valve superiorly and then to the left of that. So we're following the blood flow through the valves to listen to them. So I'm going to play some heart sounds for you so you can see hear what normal sounds are. So that's a normal heart sound. So in this case, this is auscultated or listened to through the stethoscope at the aortic valve. All right, so for somebody with a systolic murmur with severe aortic stenosis, this is what it sounds like. Does not sound healthy. And then for somebody with, this is aortic regurgitation, not mitral valve. So you listen for a murmur, so you don't get that crisp heart sound. You get kind of a whooshing associated with it. So there's our normal heart sound. Here's our stenotic heart sound. So it's sort of hitting the valves. And this is the regurgitation sound. So you get a little whooshing sound. All right, so what have we covered? A lot. So we looked at the location of the heart. So you could draw your heart on yourself, right? So the inferiormost aspect of the heart, what's the demarcation for that? Fifth intercostal space, right? What line is the lateral most left side of the heart? Mid-clavicular line. Good. So we know the location of the heart. We talked about the coverings of the heart. So we have the fibrous pericardium. There's the two layers of the serous pericardium, the parietal layer that really lines the fibrous pericardium, and the visceral layer right hugged up against the heart. And then there's the space in between those two layers, pericardial cavity that's normal. It's a potential space normally that allows for movement of the heart. Pathologic if it becomes inflamed or filled with blood, as in cardiac tamponade. We talked about the chambers of the heart, the four chambers, two atria on top, two ventricles on the bottom, but really treated as two side-by-side pumps, a right side with a right atrium and right ventricle pumping deoxygenated blood, and a left heart with a left atrium and a left ventricle pumping oxygenated blood. We talked about the valves of the heart. So we know the valve between the right atrium and the right ventricle is the tricuspid valve, right? The right atrioventricular valve. We know the valve between the right ventricle and the pulmonary artery, pulmonic or pulmonary valve, and that is a three-cusped valve, but we don't call it the tricuspid valve because that name's already been taken. So we just call it the pulmonic valve. Then we know that there's a valve between the left atrium and left ventricle. Which one is that? Mitral or bicuspid valve. And then we have a valve between the left ventricle and the aorta, which we just call the aortic valve. And we know that you can have problems with the valves. You can have stenosis, which is more likely caused by age-related changes. That's probably the most common problem. And then we can have a regurgitation or a prolapse of valves, either through weakness or damage, weakness of the papillary muscles or weakness of the valves themselves. And then we talked about some other stuff. So we talked a little bit about the conduction system just to sort of understand that there are specialized myocardial cells that are responsible for pacing the heart, and that the atria bilateral, both of them, contract together. There's a little delay, and then the ventricles contract. And that the way that that conduction gets across that fibrous skeleton is through the AV node and the bundle of His. Okay. And I think that's probably most of the stuff we talked about. Good. Okay, that's it. If you guys have questions, I'll be here.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.